This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution says Congress shall have the power to declare war. And yet the United States has gone to war again and again without a formal congressional declaration. In fact, the last time an American president asked Congress for a declaration of war was in 1941, immediately following the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Since then, one president after another, from Harry Truman to Barack Obama, has ordered American troops into wars all over the world. From Korea to Vietnam, Panama and Grenada to Lebanon, Bosnia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Now, some would argue that nuclear weapons and the advent of the United Nations have turned conflicts like these into international rather than unilateral efforts.
But according to our next guest, the decision to abandon the formal declaration of war has come at great cost. He says it's made it far too easy for presidents to commit the nation to war and vested far too much power in one man.
And he argues that ad hoc decisions by the president alone without oversight from Congress or the press has created a more unstable world. Marvin Kalb spent 30 years working for CBS and NBC and is the Edward R. Murrow Professor Emeritus at Harvard and was the founding director of the Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy at the Kennedy School. His new book is called The Road to War, Presidential Commitments Honored and Betrayed. And Marvin Kalb, welcome to Radio Boston. Great pleasure to have you.
Well, it's my pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. You point out that only five times in American history has a president asked Congress for a declaration of war, beginning with the War of 1812. And as we said, the last time was in 1941. Why is a formal declaration by Congress so important?
It's the way the country was set up. There is the Constitution, and we are all beneficiaries of an extraordinary document which has laid out the way in which this country now for more than 200 years has functioned, and most of the time not badly. In this particular case of a president accumulating enormous power to be essentially the only guy on the block with authority to commit American force to war, that is a big deal. And that is something that I've been thinking about really in terms of writing this book. I've been thinking about this, Anthony, for more than 40 years. I've done other books in the meantime, but this has been the one that I felt in good conscience I had to write.
No, and I know you've looked at this issue from a lot of different directions, too, both as a journalist and as a scholar, as a professor. Can you give me a little bit of a sort of, you know, your kind of interpretation of the Constitution, because I'm wondering if there's some ambiguity here, and maybe not, but let me give you sort of my thought about this.
Sure.
So, in other words, the Constitution gives Congress the power to declare war, but hasn't Congress done that in various ways, even if it avoided using that particular phrase? I mean, for example, Vietnam, it passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which gave President Johnson authority to go to war in Southeast Asia, even if it didn't formally declare war. Is there a difference there?
I think there is an enormous difference. In one case, there is a system at work. The president is supposed to, as the commander-in-chief, is supposed to turn to the Congress and ask it to declare war, meaning he is turning to the representatives of the American people. Mm-hmm. And he is saying, this is what I think we have to do. Do you, fellow citizens, agree with me? And if you do, declare war, and I'll go with you. The Congress has one other fundamental responsibility, according to the Constitution, and that is it has the power of the purse. If the Congress really wanted to limit a war, to end a war, all it has to do is stop the funding for the war. And when you ask the question, Anthony, about what difference, in a way, does it make, and you mentioned the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, that's a wonderful illustration of the difference. Lyndon Johnson had been carrying a draft of a kind of declaration in his hip pocket ever since he became president. And he knew that he was getting in much more deeply into Vietnam than he had any intention of doing. But he knew that there was no escape. He also knew that the American people were not probably all that happy about going in deeply into a war far away, 12,000 miles, into circumstances they truly did not understand. By the way, Johnson himself did not understand it. But He had this hip pocket resolution. He goes to Congress and he says, please give me authority to do all of this. They give him all out authority to do whatever he wants, to use any military means in defense of his judgment about what is in the interests of the United States. In other words, you have authority with this resolution to do whatever you want, and you don't have to go back to anybody. It's your game.
So it was sort of a carte blanche, in other words, to do whatever
you get a carte blanche. You can do whatever it is that you want. The Congress, in August of 1964, at the time of the resolution, by the way, that was shepherded through Congress by an Arkansas senator named J. William Fulbright, who within 1 year turned completely against the war, even though he had given Johnson the authority to do whatever he wanted. And that is the difference. You cannot, at this point, leave everything in the judgment of one man. We have a sense within the U.S. Constitution of a system of checks and balances. It's worked reasonably well, except in this one area of war. That is a rather serious area.
Yeah, serious indeed. Do you think if the presidents had gone to Congress, and let's stick with the example of Vietnam, and really said, we want, I mean, I want as president, a declaration of war, do you think that it would have turned out differently?
I think that if Johnson had gone to the Congress and laid out his case, which was essentially a Cold War case, that the communists are on the offensive, they recently took over China, there is, of course, the Soviet Union, there are communist parties throughout Europe, the entire world stands now on a communist abyss. Are we all going to be communists? The country, of course, and the Congress, of course, would say no. Do whatever you feel is necessary. If at the end of the day what you end up with here is a fine distinction that only scholars can play games with, I would argue on my side of the argument that it is so important, and let me give you one illustration. As a result of the fact that Congress no longer lives up to its responsibilities in an area of declaring war, no longer truly lives up to its responsibilities either on the power of the purse. The president then, even without asking for it, assumes all of those powers, and he can do essentially what he wishes. So he goes around the world, and whatever the issue be, whether it is Iraq, Afghanistan, in the Middle East, with respect to China, Korea, the split in Korea, which is dangerous now, to say the least, he provides the world with so-called presidential commitments. He can, on his own, simply by virtue of saying it, commit the United States to a military action. Because once the president, quote, commits the United States to do something, then the integrity, the word of the president becomes the word of the United States. And that means that the United States could be committed to doing just about anything a president wants. Even though a president can be in office only 8 years, the new guy comes in, he's got all of these commitments. It's very difficult to back out of presidential commitments.
In fact, you make the point, I think, very well and very interestingly about these presidential commitments. I mean, going back to Vietnam, I mean, you point out that Eisenhower sort of planted this idea of a commitment to Vietnam that was then picked up by Kennedy and then, of course, escalated in a big way by Johnson, and on we went for a very long time in 58,000. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, let me tell you, I think that's a terrific example of a presidential commitment gone haywire. In the late spring of 1959, Dwight Eisenhower, who in 1954, by the way, at the Geneva Convention, christened, gave birth to South Vietnam. He didn't have to. He did. Then South Vietnam becomes part of the so-called, in those years, the free world. Okay. In 1959, Ike goes before a graduating class, and he says this. These are not his exact words, but they're awfully close. The continued existence of a free and independent, non-communist South Vietnam is in the direct national security interest of the United States. Well, thank you very much. When the next president comes in, John Kennedy, a young man, but he had his own war experience. He knew what was going on. But Eisenhower, the great leader of World War II, a successful president with two terms, he says it's in the direct national interest. And I said, how is the next guy to pull out? It's almost impossible. And that is what I was trying to say in this book, that time and time again, you have examples of presidential commitments, statements uttered by a president that become the inescapable commitment of the United States of America.
Listeners, we're talking to Marvin Kalb. He spent 30 years reporting for CBS and NBC. He's the author of the book, The Road to War, Presidential Commitments Honored and Betrayed. He's also the Edward R. Murrow Professor Emeritus at Harvard. And listeners, we want you to join the conversation. Should the president ask for declarations of war? Do you buy Marvin Kalb's thesis here? Or is that an antiquated an idea? Would it make a difference? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and at Radio Boston. And Marvin Kalb, let's bring this up to date, because speaking of commitment, the question about presidential commitment, the question about the authority to use military force has cropped up since the war in Iraq, in Libya, for instance. And here was President Obama from August 20th, 2012, talking about the scope of the Syrian conflict and what would trigger greater American involvement. Let's just listen for a second.
We have been very clear to the Assad regime, but also to other players on the ground, that a red line for us is we start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons moving around or being utilized. That would change my calculus. That would change my equation.
So there it is. Chemical weapons are a red line that would change his calculus. Marvin Kalb, do you see President Obama slowly slipping toward war in Syria, again without congressional declaration and with the same set of circumstances that you've identified going back to the days of Truman?
Let me just say, very, very sadly, the answer is yes. I think that the president has trapped himself by the usual eloquence of his language into saying something that become personal commitments that then, because he's president, become national commitments of the country. If the United States right now continued to stand aside and to let the so-called good guys lose decisively, and Assad remains in power in Syria, the United States and Obama himself have been humiliated. No president wants that. And I get a sense that we are slipping inexorably into a deeper commitment that will involve in some way the use of military force. In Libya, a couple of years ago, this President Obama did not want to put boots on the ground. And so what he did was he limited himself in a military sense to intelligence, to the Air Force, and to helping our key allies, France and Britain, do what they felt they had to do in Libya to get rid of Gaddafi. So the U.S. at that time was constrained, and this is also kind of interesting, Anthony. In 1973, there was the War Powers Act, which very specifically limits an American president to what he can do in a war. But it was an absurd piece of legislation with language that nobody could ever live up to. But nevertheless, it's the law of the land.
But it's rarely lived up to, isn't it?
It's very rarely lived up to. And I was going to say the president concerning Libya never even went to the Congress to ask them anything. He just did whatever he wanted to do. And that's the kind of example that is so crucial. It is equally important with respect to the U.S. relationship with Israel. That is based right now on private presidential letters, public presidential assurances of American support, and answers by an Israeli prime minister. But there are no rules of the road. There is no treaty establishing a way that both countries know what is going to happen. If one president leaves office, there is no guarantee that the next president is going to live up to the same commitments to Israel as the former president. And I've had the privilege, Anthony, as a reporter, to have had long, long conversations. I've covered the Middle East story for more than 50 years. I terrify myself when I say that. but I've been able to talk to people like Golda Meir, Menachem Begin, Yitzhak Rabin, and all of them keep on saying the same thing. Send us the guns, protect us at the UN, send us some money, and we'll do our own fighting. But at the end of the day right now, it has become an Israeli idea that somehow or other the U.S. and Israel ought to, at the end of a negotiation, to sort of complete it, have a U.S.-Israeli mutual defense treaty. Again, this is something that is so serious, so important, the possibility of war in Syria, the follow-up possibility with Iran. You're talking big-time stuff. It cannot be left just to the word of one man, even if he's president.
And yet it seems that through history for a while now it has. I want to talk more about this idea of a formal treaty with Israel, but first I want to get some callers into the conversation. We're talking to Marvin Kalb, who wrote The Road to War, Presidential Commitments Honored and Betrayed, and we're talking about this tendency of the U.S. to slip into war, largely based on the views and the word of one president rather than a congressional declaration of war. Let's go to Paul, who's calling from Acton. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. One of the things I've always thought about is that the creation of a professional army has given the green light to any president to use military means without worrying about the public, because the public says, oh, they're all professionals, all volunteered. Why not? Because it doesn't affect our children or anybody else's children unless they already agree to do that. And I think that's been a great motivator, a freedom of the president to do whatever he pleases along military means.
Paul, thanks so much for that point. Let me turn it over to Marvin Kalb.
I think that Paul is a very, very wise man. One of the key reasons why I personally have become so concerned about this is that at this point, since we do have an all-volunteer force, think about the numbers for just one sec. The all-volunteer force represents 0.6% of the American people, defending 99.4% of the American people. And there is a gap, a chasm opening up between the interests of the professional military and the interests of the American people. But in terms of a president going into war and making it so easy, the president is now like an old-time European monarch with his own army. He can go to war with his own army anywhere in the world. He is the commander-in-chief. There is no one in the Congress who is going to stand up and say, Mr. President, we're not going to give you money to lead the troops. That just doesn't happen. Nobody, no politician would want to be in that position. So I thank Paul very much for raising that issue.
I think Paul also puts his, and you just articulated something that I've thought about a lot. And I'm wondering again, to just get back to this issue about the Constitution, where Congress, of course, has the power to declare war, but the president is the commander in chief.
Yes.
Doesn't that sort of build into the Constitution sort of an obvious ambiguity there? I mean, where the separation of these powers isn't as crystal clear as it might be. Do you think that's sort of where some of this problem begins?
Yeah, and Anthony, I think that bit of ambiguity was built in quite deliberately. You don't ever want to put into language that locks people into positions from which they cannot move no matter what they argue. So that kind of ambiguity, that sort of flexibility was part of the original contract between or among the three branches of government and then the American people. Everybody was supposed to function together in the common interests of everybody. It was never conceived that one human being, even though he's president, I grant that immediately, that one human being have the wisdom, the genius, all of that that is necessary to lead a country into war. It's not the same thing as passing legislation on a trade act, for example. This is a decision where you're sending people off to die, to die. And that is too important to be left in the hands of one person.
Marvin Kalb, you also talk very interestingly about not only sort of the congressional constitutional authority that is being overlooked here, but you have words to say about the press's responsibility as well,
yes,
especially when it comes to the lead up of to sort of the opening debate about whether we should be going to war or not.
Yeah. One of the most difficult things for me to do, Anthony, I'm an old man, and I was a journalist for many, 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 many years. And so I go back all the way to the Eisenhower administration. I remember the way things were done then, and I know the way things are done now. There are wonderful, terrific journalists who are covering stories today. In this country, in Boston, the Bulger trial, the recent horrible terrorist action in Boston, it was magnificently covered up to a point. And that point is that no one any longer has the time to think. Mm. Everything is live. And so you cut to a battlefield, you cut to an event on Capitol Hill. Everybody is supposed to be a great genius, figure it all out instantly, and tell you in a live manner what has just happened, and that is not enough. You also have to analyze what it is that you've just said. So you are the front page and the op-ed page all at the same time. And people get confused about what is news and what is opinion. And it seems to me that, forgive me on this, in the old days we were clearer about that distinction, and the American people had a better shot at understanding fact from opinion.
You know, it's sort of ironic because I think one of the things you're talking about there is that because of the way communication works so instantly now,
exactly,
we can get there so much quicker and be there all day long. And in one sense, that should be a positive thing because we have,
yes,
access to what's going on. But you're saying that it sort of works against us because it doesn't give us time to step back and consider it carefully.
No, but you're absolutely right. And please forgive me if I suggested that there are no good things about the modern technology. There are, and they are obvious. I am only saying that with those good things come a set of problems that must be addressed that you cannot hide from. It seems to me, for example, that if you are a foreign correspondent and you are based in Moscow, you ought to be able to speak Russian. If you're based in China, speak Chinese.
Mm.
In Japan or in France, speak French. Don't go in there and then be dependent on other people to help you cover the news. Do it yourself.
Well, Marvin Kalb, it's a great and provocative thesis. Thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about it. I'm sorry we don't have more time. That's Marvin Kalb. His book is The Road
Thank
to
you,
War.
Anthony.
Thank you. His book is The Road to War, Presidential Commitments Honored and Betrayed. And Marvin Kalb, the Edward R. Murrow Professor Emeritus at Harvard and author of The Road to War, Presidential Commitments Honored and Betrayed. Listeners, tell us what you think. You can post comments at radioboston.org. And stay with us. There's more show coming up. Did you take your vitamins today? Well, maybe you shouldn't have. Or maybe you should have. I'm not sure. We'll bring you the truth about vitamins. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.